And we're back here on 93.3 CFMU FM. You're listening to Unusual Sources being broadcast 93.3 on the FM dial here in Hamilton and at cfmu.mcmaster.ca to the rest of the world. And as we promised last week, I'm very delighted to bring you Professor Maximilian C. Forte. He's an associate professor in anthropology at Concordia University in Montreal. And he has distinguished himself with his excellent blog, Open Anthropology. It details everything from Western media coverage of the Iranian elections in 2009 to modern neocolonialism and the ideology that justifies corporate globalization. Max, welcome again to the program.
Thank you very much, Brendan. It's a real pleasure to be with you again.
Well, I'm just saying to our listeners, we're privileged to have you with us today. I know how busy you are with your academic schedule and all the articles that you write and the detailed analysis that you do that you really can't find elsewhere. If you're not reading Maximilian Forte's blog, then you're not being fully informed. You need to read these materials. Very timely analysis, as we saw in the last few weeks, such as when you were on the Taylor Report, Max. Now, what you were discussing with Phil Taylor on that program is something that we like to talk about on this program here. I refer to it as the do-something crowd, the group of people that we'll talk about who we are later on, but we have to do something about various situations in the world, and we're going to expand on some of those ideas today. When I was reading your excellent article, and I'm just going to mention the title of that, it was reproduced in many places, Monthly Review Zine and other publications around the internet, and the title of that was Libya, Lather, Rinse, Repeat, Syria, Liberal Imperialism, and the Refusal to Learn. And that's what this week's program is all about, the inability or refusal to learn. And looking at your materials, it made me think of something from 2006. A few years ago, there was a group in Britain that published something called the Euston Manifesto. And you may have heard of this one. It said that we, the anti-war movement, place too much criticism on Western governments. We're too supportive of the Iraqi resistance, too supportive of Palestinian rights. So they said we should focus on attacking what they call tyranny and support Western values of liberty, equality, and democracy. And they don't like to see too much criticism of the United States, which they characterize as a strong and stable democracy. Does that sound familiar to you at all, Max?
Yeah, very much, unfortunately. On the one hand, I'm sure that some people will react, and I wouldn't blame them, and I'm not disagreeing, but they'll react by saying, well, this is a misappropriation of the left. This is a kind of fake left posing as a new left. To some extent, we see it right here in Canada, where at one time the federal NDP wanted Canada out of NATO, was not afraid of using the word socialism, and closely identified or at least openly supported a number of revolutionary movements in Central America that were engaged in armed rebellion against regimes supported by the United States. So they took very sort of unpopular positions from the elite's perspective, and they continued with that until, you know, the last few years. Now they've sort of, disinfected their terminology. Now you hear things such as, we're fighting for families. Which families? Are you fighting equally for the very rich families as you do for the very poor families? You see, there's no distinction. No distinction because class has been removed.
Yeah.
And they've also adopted the liberal imperialist discourse of Michael Ignatieff and Lloyd Axworthy, liberals, in adopting and endorsing the whole responsibility to protect idea, especially when they had that discussion in Parliament recently, for which only the Green Party, in other words, one person, voted against the renewal of Canadian involvement in Libya. At that point, now that unfortunately, for as much as I very much respected and liked Jack Layton, now that they don't have a leader, they should possibly consider offering the position to Michael Ignatieff, because the positions are not that different. certainly not on foreign policy.
It would certainly be tragic to see a further move in that direction. We're definitely living in a time where politics has shifted to the right wing. I think in many respects, Ronald Reagan would have difficulty getting elected as a Republican because his views would be considered too left-wing.
It's not all that far-fetched, but as I was saying before, I think, you know, this is one way to approach it. There is another way to approach it, which I think goes somewhat deeper to the root of the problem. I think what we're living through now is a kind of growing anxiety that's basically framed in civilizational terms. That is the West versus the rest. And there are a number of people on what we now have to call the so-called left, because we don't really know what left is anymore, who have essentially taken the position that when it comes down to it, in other words, when it comes down to a clash between civilizations, we have to all remember that we're all basically on the same team. And you see this over and over again. For example, you know that a lot of WikiLeaks supporters have been inflamed by the reaction of not just the U.S. government, the State Department, Justice Department, but also American corporations in trying to shut down and persecute WikiLeaks. And they were up in arms, well, in virtual terms, about that. As it came time for the vote on a no-fly zone and on military intervention in Libya, some of the very high-profile supporters of WikiLeaks, just to give you one example, J.P. Barlow of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but there are others, people like Bianca Jagger and so on, came out in support of the war. And I'm thinking, you cannot have it both ways, because war demands secrecy for operations. Operational security, national security, expansion of the whole system of classifying information, withholding the truth from the public, all of those things are amplified and magnified by war.
Exactly.
So when you're supporting the war and then claiming to also be a WikiLeaks supporter, you're living in a state of contradiction. But
no, yeah, exactly. And it reminds me of something that goes all the way back to C.L.R. James when he said, where there is no instability, the imperialists seek to create it. And we've seen intervention in Libya, we're seeing it in Syria, and we've been watching it over the last 10 years in the Middle East. And they've been calling it the war on terror. And a lot of people, civil libertarians, the kind of people that support WikiLeaks early on, back in 2001, 2002, were warning us that as we sent troops to Afghanistan and Iraq and suppressed people's free speech on the issue of the war and of police state and so forth, that this war would come home, that things would be brought back to us, that they would start with Muslims, take away their civil liberties, monitor them, tag them, as you saw with the GPS devices that have been seen on the cars of some Muslim Americans that were put there by the government. So they start there and then they move on, and soon other people are afraid to speak up. And so all the criticisms and warnings that were brought out early in the war on terror about how a colonial war would be brought home, how the violence would come home, how the repression would come home, the end of speech, the silence, that is what is happening here right now.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, you know, this is why also at one point I said so-called left, because some of these warnings, you know, basically the idea of counterinsurgency is always domestic. It begins domestically and it returns home. Amplified, perhaps. You know, some of the people that articulated these views in different ways, talking about blowback, individuals such as the late Chalmers Johnson. Chalmers Johnson was no leftist. He worked with the CIA, and I believe he was also a registered Republican. And his concept of blowback, you know, really articulates the kind of view that you mentioned. So in terms of ideological camps, everything has become quite blurry, which is why when individuals such as Juan Cole presume to write an open letter to the left, chastising them and browbeating them for not supporting intervention in Libya, you have to wonder, what left is he talking about? And why is he ignoring so many on the right who were also opposed to the war? So it's a big ideological mess. But as I said, what pins down certain individuals is this kind of civilizational perspective, that we're all on the same team. You know, NATO can be reformed, perhaps. We can push back on the overclassification of information. But on the other hand, it's a useful tool. It's ours, ultimately, to pursue this global human rights agenda.
Yes. Yes.
You know, we're all in the family, is the kind of attitude. And I don't think we are.
No, and you're bringing together a lot of issues here that really interest me. I remember with those Houston folks, for example, many of these people claim to be on the left, and they supported the war in Iraq. They support the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, and they even put in a document, we must define ourselves against those for whom the entire progressive agenda has been subordinated to a blanket and simplistic anti-imperialism or hostility to the United States. So they want to push people away from the idea that we should be against imperialism, that we should be talking about what the United States government is doing. And I thought with the disaster of the Iraq war and what happened in Afghanistan, this ongoing occupation, that the legitimacy of this liberal imperialism might have diminished among some people. And certainly it has among the general population. But with Obama coming in, it seems that the old, you know, Clinton era liberal intervention has come back stronger than ever. And it really was sad to see Juan Cole and a number of Obama careerists pushing it. And some people have suggested it's a partisan issue. So Juan Cole is supporting this war because it's a Democrat Party war, whereas he was against the Bush wars. But it's more complex than that, as you've been hinting at, because what we're looking at now is what Cindy Sheehan called both wings or two wings of the war party. There's the pro-war Democrats and the pro-war Republicans. And the opinion on this issue is being divided between anti-war, and that can be people on the right, people on the left, and people who support interventions. And to get to this idea of supporting interventions, supporting it on the left, you need to push that humanitarian agenda, that liberal agenda. And you mentioned Samuel Huntington, and that's incredible because this does go back to the clash of civilizations. Huntington, for all the claim of support of democracy, he feared democracy in the Arab states. He said that if democracy were to be extended to most Middle Eastern countries today, fundamentalist regimes would take power as they appear to represent the will of the general populace. So I'm not sure how comfortable Huntington was with what he understood as democracy in the Arab world. But this clash of civilizations is being pushed, as you said, the idea that we in a dying empire in Britain, in the United States and Canada, that we are at the top, that we represent the epitome, the height of civilization, and everyone else has to catch up to us. And we therefore need to impose our human rights on them. And it fundamentally neglects actual human rights, what's been defined as global human rights. And this is where you said, and Phil Taylor quoted this on the Taylor Report, because it's such an excellent comment, that NATO and the West supports the right to tweet, but not to eat. And that's critical because on the one hand, we talk about negative rights. We talk about certain civil liberties or certain liberties, right to free speech, right not to have things imposed on you. But there are a number of positive rights that were developed at the end of World War II, and it was perhaps one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century that a number of countries could come together, even if they were kind of corralled into it. But they came together and said, if we're going to have human rights, there should be social and economic rights. People have the right to eat. There's something called the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Articles.
Right.
You know, you probably know it requires fair wages and safe workplaces. You've been showing us that there's a whole second level of human rights.
Yeah.
But the West is ignoring this. I mean, they don't want us to think that it exists.
No, that's right, because, of course, it goes against the grain of corporate domination to enforce those rights and to take them seriously. And this is where the complexities come in with regards to the very conflicting positions on Libya, and especially on this figure of Muammar Gaddafi. If you don't mind, I would just like to detain here for a moment, and I know that metaphors can be very poor, and sometimes when you use a metaphor, the idea is to get off of it as quickly as possible. But it simplifies things, but it also puts them in a way that I think anthropologists would appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume Muammar Gaddafi in Libya can be likened to a family. This is the head of the household, Gaddafi. He's a very rich man. They live in a mansion. His children, his wife, they're all abundantly provided for. They go without nothing, you know. I mean, they certainly never have to worry about food or their future, their anything in terms of economic and material goods, no problem. Unfortunately, he has a tendency on occasion to beat his wife, and on occasion with some of the children, because he has favorites and others that are less favorite, on occasion he terrorizes some of his children. Others' children that are treated abundantly well think he is a golden father, and that maybe some of the siblings have been behaving badly and have deserved the kind of treatment that they got. Outside the home, where few people are aware of what's really going on inside his home, outside of his home, he's loved by the community. He gives to charity, he performs public service, he's very charming, he's very genteel, and people outside of that home think, you know, this man is actually quite wonderful. Now, what I want to say is, because of those inconsistencies, or what people would call contradictions, exist, that doesn't mean that one of those Gaddafis, one of those faces, or a number of them, are fake. No, they're all real. They're all him. They are all aspects and dimensions of who he is. So outside of Libya, the movements that he's supported across Latin America and Africa, the various aid and investments and so on that he's supported, that he's really abundantly contributed to raising the quality of life of many people in different parts of the world, one has to understand why he would have those supporters and why they would have absolutely no need to disown him and to apologize for being attracted to him. And it doesn't mean that he hasn't abused human rights in his country. That's another perspective. People within that country with legitimate grievances against Gaddafi possibly can't appreciate how and why there would be others elsewhere who instead see Gaddafi as a kind of heroic figure. All of these things are going on. Individuals such as Juan Cole have no appreciation for this fact. Individuals such as Juan Cole have gone to the other extreme. Well, there are two extremes. One is to demonize Gaddafi, to say he's absolute evil. He's capable of no good, and to totally ignore the serious and significant social and economic achievements that took place in Libya under Gaddafi's rule. Something that, and your listeners might be interested in tracking this on their own, something that the website of the United States State Department right now still recognizes. Right at the top, you'll see for their country profile of Libya a link to a Library of Congress country study, and in that study they showcase all the tremendous achievements on the social welfare front that have occurred in Libya under Gaddafi. So they're aware of this. And very few people would dispute that fact. For Cole and those like him, instead, Gaddafi's all evil. There's nothing good that can be said about him. As for these freedom fighters, they're the opposite. They're like saints and angels. Only good can be spoken of them. So the fact that they've engaged in racist lynching, that's something we're all supposed to be silent about and somehow overlook.
Well, you know, Edward S. Herman, I believe it was, and Stephen Gowans both spoke about the angelization of opposition and demonization of governments. So when
Absolutely.
We don't like... Yeah, that's what we're getting here. And in terms of crimes, that's a very interesting point, because as soon as the rebels entered Tripoli, according to CNN yesterday or 2 days ago, as soon as that battle occurred in the capital, the ICC came out, the International Criminal Court, and said, we've got a warrant for Gaddafi's arrest. You know, we've got all our charges lined up and everything. So right on cue, as soon as the imperial forces enter Tripoli, as soon as the NATO forces take the capital, ICC comes in right on cue and says, yeah, we've got our war crimes charges all lined up. So there's no war crimes charges for the rebels.
Yes.
There's no war crimes charges for NATO, and you could take 20 minutes on all the crimes they've committed. We know what the UN resolution said. After they were strong-armed into making that resolution, we then had something that escalated far beyond that point. But I understand the African Union is not recognizing this warrant, or they've said that they're not going to support this arrest warrant for Gaddafi. Is there any sort of confrontation occurring between these Western organizations and what's happening locally in the African Union?
Well, no, you're right. That was the African Union's position. I mean, from the point of view of credibility and legitimacy, the ICC has absolutely ruined itself in Africa, because this has been this is a pattern of behavior. It's not once that they've adopted this kind of selective approach to prosecuting human rights abuses. It's amazing to me that Human Rights Watch, which came out in support of the intervention and still produces these reports that tend to be biased in the sense that emphasizing that the majority of the crimes were committed by Gaddafi and they outweigh all else, that even so, it is pressing the ICC to at least investigate rebel atrocities which did in fact occur and which Human Rights Watch, among others, documented. We'll see if that happens. I doubt it.
Yeah, you know, there's going to be a lot more atrocities we're going to see in Libya. I don't know if our media is going to cover it, but that comes to another important issue, and that is the media, because I was watching CNN this morning, and I could get my notes out here. Basically, a lot of people probably saw the same broadcast. A reporter was talking about how relieved he was that the bombing was ending, or the war was apparently ending, that the what he called the pro-Gaddafi diehard loyalists were leaving his hotel because they had that hotel under guard. And he was saying, I'm really relieved because I thought my life was in danger with these pro-Gaddafi elements walking around. And the reason I thought my life was in danger is because they were accusing me of things. They were accusing the media, they said. And this is he said, these Libyan armed forces thought that the international media was part of the war machine. And this greatly offended the CNN reporter and caused him fear. And he said, why would anyone think that the media is part of the war machine?
Yes, that's right. No, those are excellent points. And in many cases, you know, what impresses me also is not just the times where agencies such as CNN have taken part in building up certain myths that originate with the rebels, such as, Viagra-fueled mass rape, CNN report, and it was CNN, I think, was alone in doing this, reported a story about, oh yes, there's this video on a cell phone that the rebels found. I mean, a totally implausible story. And,
but anything.
You know, but the videos are all being destroyed because it's to protect the honor of the women being.
There were videos about the rebels that weren't being shown on CNN. But anything that the rebels produce isn't even vetted. It's just sent automatically to CNN. It gets broadcast on CNN, BBC, sometimes France 24, Al Jazeera, and CBC, and so on. And what's really what really shocked me here is that the CNN reporter was surprised at being perceived as part of the war machine, when in fact, if you look at CNN and the other news outlets at the beginning of this intervention back in February, they were reporting saying NATO has established a no-fly zone over Libya to protect Libyan civilians and will be conducting operations to ensure the safety of Libyan airspace. So that's what they were saying on day one and week one and so on, while NATO was beginning a bombardment of ground targets in Libya, with Canadian military commands selecting target after target after target after target in Libya. And the whole way through, they've been cheerleading and covering for NATO, and it gets to the point 4 months later. Now, think about this. Think about how Orwellian this is. Day one and week one was NATO no-fly zone protecting civilians, all the way down to today's coverage, which is, you know, the last Gaddafi elements are being driven away from the capital as the rebels supported by NATO enter Tripoli and secure democracy and liberty and freedom. It's the end of the Gaddafi regime. We're fighting the last holdouts and the diehard elements. So that's quite a change from we're here to establish a no-fly zone to we are removing the Gaddafi regime and putting in our own rebels, like Northern Alliance, and talking about post-Iraq strategies. And that's what do you think of that? A lot of the discourse now is saying we can't make the same mistakes we made in Iraq by not having enough of a structure to turn things over to. We need to make sure that the rebels are connected with the rest of the world and connected with one another so that they can maintain a post-occupation order.
No, I want to speak a bit more about what you said about CNN. I mean, that kind of complicity has been obvious. And in this sense, this war has resembled the war in Iraq in its early stages almost identically, where the media performed the role of war boosters. But what is interesting to me, and this is might be an idea of how to read the media, is when they themselves, and I mean those who are fully on the side of NATO and its mission, report things that they don't seem to be aware of the significance of what they're reporting. So I mean CNN a few days ago, in reporting the killing of the brother of the Libyan government spokesman, he was killed in Zawiya. You know, they mention that he's a civilian, he's unarmed, he's with a group of men in the central square of Zawiya, and a U.S. Apache helicopter gunned them down. You know, you are just describing the deliberate targeting of unarmed civilians, as we saw in the collateral murder video that was released by WikiLeaks. That's what you've just described. No comment, no uproar. I've got in front of me here something similar. It's from the Telegraph, you know, the UK's
yes.
Telegraph. The date is the 22nd of August, 2011. It's very short. I'm going to read it out. 30 or so rebels had detained two black men. This is in a mansion that they were looting in Tripoli. 30 or so rebels had detained two black men. We don't know if they're Libyan or not, forced them on their hunkers, slapped them on the head, and accused them of being mercenaries still fighting for Gaddafi. They are from Chad. They've admitted they were mercenaries, even though they first claimed to be groundsmen, said one of the rebels. The writer says, either story was plausible, but the condition of the compound gave credence to the squatting detainees' initial claims. A sprinkler system threw up a fine mist of water over imported ferns, and a clean terracotta driveway led to serene rows of marble-floored villas. So in other words, the journalist is seeing evidence that these people were tending to the ground, were unarmed, and their primary crime is in being black. This is in the Telegraph, and it's just from 2 days ago. And this, you know, no comment, no analysis, not understanding even the significance of what they've just printed. And the rest of the article goes on to the usual, you know, sympathetic overview of what the rebels are doing. And this is happening time and again. So sometimes within the same media, you can find these valuable bits of information that they print because they don't have themselves an understanding
well,
of what
right.
it is that
I mean,
they're writing.
They're embedded, in a sense.
And, that's right. And oh, they have been.
They've embedded themselves with the rebels since the beginning, since February
exactly.
or earlier. We know that there's problems among the NATO and Western journalists. There's suspicions of various numbers of them working officially for NATO governments. But it doesn't really matter because they're unofficially working for NATO governments anyway. And this talk of mercenaries is very interesting because, again, these groups that the West is supporting in Libya, being engaged in racist crimes and other crimes, being given a free pass. Meanwhile, we know about other mercenary activity within Libya. We know that NATO has hired mercenaries. We know that France, Qatar, Canada, United States, and so on have been equipping and training the rebels. There was a story in today's Globe and Mail about military drones that Canada gave to rebel forces. So
right.
these are the good guy forces that we're supporting despite the crimes. We saw what happened when our government officially recognized the Transitional National Council. It was only one day after that they killed General Yunus. So one day after being recognized right. by our foreign ministry. We have this infighting and murder, which appears to have been premeditated if you're looking on certain websites. So if you want to find out about the mercenaries that we're supporting in Libya, the crimes, the bombs, and so forth, I mean, there's a lot of websites you can turn to. There's Monthly Review Zine, there's your blog, there's Global Research, there's antiwar.com, there's Counterpunch, there's Information Clearinghouse, there's Dissident Voice, and so on. I mean, these are where you can get the information. Our media sure isn't doing a good job. They're just continuing talking about what we have to do. And that's one of the things that you have done an excellent job in highlighting. And it's this we. I know you were referring to Robert Fisk's recent writings on the subject yeah. of Syria. Going by your article, you were able to quote him. And he was making comments. He said, the trouble is everyone has been running out of patience with Syria since the spring. And yeah. I love that. I mean, that everyone.
That's right. You see, we're all on the same team again. You can universalize. We all have the same perspective. If I could just interrupt for a second, you are probably familiar with the writing of Glenn Greenwald.
Yes.
And Glenn Greenwald is a writer that I very much respect, very much like the vast majority of what he's written, is very critical, very perceptive, very insightful, very honest. Recently, maybe a day or two ago, in an article on Libya, towards the bottom somewhere, it's sort of in passing, he makes the point that, no decent human being, would support someone like Gaddafi. And, you know, this is in an article where he says, because you're against the war, we've been accused of being pro-Gaddafi and so on. You'd think he was pushing back at that, but then he inserts that line at the end. It keeps him on safe ground. It keeps him writing for Salon. It keeps him getting invited on American news programs and so on.
He's
covered his backside.
I have to really interrupt because this is extremely important what you're saying here. I deeply respect Glenn Greenwald's writings. I also regularly read his column, and I think he's been doing mostly a great job. But what he did here is you had to sort of show a little bit of fealty or pay allegiance by doing so. A Democracy Now, they do a lot of anti-war reporting and a lot of great coverage, which I support. Every now and then, though, whenever suspect information comes out from Libyan rebels or about Iran or Syria, the first story always goes to people like Juan Cole.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you can always rely on them to give the government position, in a sense.
Yes, that's right.
I think with Juan Cole, there was a recent article that just came out today. He was commenting, I think this was on Democracy Now, actually. He said, and you probably haven't heard this yet or haven't had time to read it, but I'll quote directly. He says, "We're seeing a revolution coming to its final phase. We're seeing yet another popular cascade. The reason for which the freedom fighters could enter the capital so easily, many of them just walked in or drove in and came relatively quickly to the center of the city, was because the city had already overthrown the regime." So in the view of Juan Cole, there was no NATO intervention. There was not the employment of every weapon in the NATO arsenal over the last 4 months, and particularly in the last 48 hours around Tripoli, to establish that effect. It was a popular uprising. It was the people rising up.
Yes, I am actually familiar with that particular piece and with his recent appearance on Democracy Now! And my view of Juan Cole is an especially negative one that might not be shared by all of your listeners. I believe that what he's been writing about Libya for these past few months, and I've been looking every now and again, has been very superficial material based on questionable sources or no known sources, such as his description of what happened in Tripoli when he's not there, and therefore he should have at least indicated according to whom did this popular uprising happen in Tripoli as the rebels entered, because I haven't seen that description in many other sources.
Mm.
He's been writing glowing fairy tales. As we were saying earlier on, this is Obama's war, and he supports it.
Yes.
When it was Bush's war, he didn't support it. even though the logic was very much the same.
No, there's been a lot of disappointment, and I think in part it's because, as you've said, we barely have a left in the West, in North America, at least. And it goes back to that viewpoint that we were articulating, the viewpoint that people like Juan Cole appear to be representing, and that is the Western viewpoint, the we, the royal we, or the imperial we, that yeah. we're in the same boat on this, that we need to get rid of Gaddafi, we need to do something in Syria, we need to put pressure on Iran, and we already know what kind of intervention people like Robert Fisk want in Syria.
Yeah.
But that idea that we need to do something, that we are the ones to make that decision, you know, it's like we're sitting on the edge of a cliff overlooking the rest of the world saying, you know, oh, look at those things happening over there. We need to fix that. And it goes back to the skewed view of human rights, the limited view of human rights. We know after World War II, again, the views of human rights were sort of imposed on a lot of the world that didn't have a lot of say in the matter. But when they were able to consult the developing countries, the non-aligned movement, and so on, those countries were emphasizing and got part of the UN Constitution those social and economic rights.
That's right.
And unfortunately, you've had people like Arthur Schlesinger who's asserted that Europe is the unique source of what we associate with human rights and democracy today. And that view has been making the resurgence. So that is the view that we are seeing. And I think if you're going to say that we need to promote human rights, that we, the NATO countries, need to promote human rights, they need to talk about human rights in its totality as it was established by the entire world. And that is rights that give you the right to eat, not just the right to tweet. You can't cherry pick. I mean, if you're going to talk about human rights, you have to talk about all the human rights.
Right, right. But you know what else is going on is that and then this is something that one sees repeatedly. With this emphasis on fixing what's wrong in other societies, there is the implicit understanding that we can do this because our own societies are that much better, that much more advanced, and are the standard by which to measure others. And therefore, we don't have a problem with democracy and freedom and human rights at home. And in fact, these huge concepts, very complex ones, which used to be the subject of sustained and intense debate, are now taken for granted, passed along without definition, as if, you know, this is something that we possess, and it's not something to be debated. So the idea is, it's easy for a leftist, oh, and by the way, usually that's preceded by the term armchair, it's easy for an armchair leftist to condemn military intervention in Libya when you already have the comfort of freedom and democracy at home. And I'm thinking, do we? Who said? Well, this is a debate that needs to happen.
Yes.
What do you mean by freedom? What do you mean by democracy? That some stranger comes to the door during an election period and essentially tells me, not in these words, never, of course, but essentially this is what they're saying, I'm here to ask you to surrender your power to me, and I'm going to claim to represent you, but I'm going to do what I want to do. In fact, I'm here to tell you what I want to do. I'm not here to ask you
We're supposed to forget about that. We're supposed to ignore, you know, the riots in the United Kingdom and the disaffection with the established political apparatus when we think about promoting democracy. So forget about what happened at the BART, you know, in the United States. Don't think about what happened with the UK riots. Don't think about the G20. Don't think about any of those things when we talk about promoting democracy. It's the same kind of mental disconnect that you need to have when you think about promoting democracy and human rights while forgetting about Iraq and forgetting about Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
You know, we have to have that mental disconnect. We have to have that forgetting if we can think about intervening in other countries.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, it's kind of preposterous even for Canada to be advocating democracy as being something that is a result of elections. It's preposterous because a large part of our government is unelected.
But it's part, exactly. And
you know, we have an unelected Senate. We had an official head of state who's a bloody monarch.
Well, the monarch
wasn't elected.
The monarchs are the only people that are safe right now. If you look at Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, where the U.S. military bases and friends are, those monarchs are safe. And people like Gaddafi are not safe. Syria is not safe. But the U.S.-friendly monarchies, you can guarantee they, along with the Queen of England, will be safe in this NATO. And it goes to the commercialization of thought. And this is what your article concludes with. It's the ultimate important conclusions. The way that these wars are pitched, not just the foreign wars, but also the domestic war on our own people that's happening here, you know, and our own people is another term we'll have to look at. But it seems the United States government and NATO views its citizens as passive consumers of information. So we're given products to consume, like the victory celebration in Green Square and so on. And it reminds me of what William Gibson described, the way that NATO seems to view people. Here's what William Gibson said. He said, "Personally, I like to imagine something the size of a baby hippo, the color of a week-old boiled potato that lives by itself in the dark in a double wide on the outskirts of Topeka. It is covered with eyes and it sweats constantly. The sweat runs into those eyes and makes them sting. It has no mouth, Laney, no genitals, and can only express its mute extremes of murderous rage and infantile desire by changing the channels on a universal remote or by voting in presidential elections." And I think that what William Gibson's description there mirrors the way NATO views consumers. The citizens are consumers. We consume the information they give us, and we're supposed to get all riled up when they give us stories about atrocities. So if something happens on the ground and the Libyan rebels or the embedded journalists forward it onto the media, who then transfer that information to us, the passive mass of consumers, a passive mob, who are supposed to feel upset and angry so that we therefore support an invasion, support war. That's also how they interpret the UK riots, isn't it? Because they just thought the rioters were basically people that were just swept by a wave of irrationality.
Yes, that's right. No, that's exactly it. And I've been looking at, you know, that they look at people in such terms is not altogether surprising. I mean, I've been paying attention at some of the trends in social media, especially surrounding Libya. In February, there was this huge swelling of attention on the protests, on the conflict and so on, up until basically the West got involved militarily. Then for 4 or 5 months, the population of those paying attention dwindled. It came down to those with a hardcore interest of some sort, people who sympathize with the rebels or the very anti-NATO types such as myself. Come now this so-called fall of Tripoli, there's this huge swelling in the population on different social media of people paying attention. So they've gone to from the grief and the outcry, the outrage. Oh, look what he's doing to his own people. Then for the next few months, they ignored it. They went on to other things. They come back at the end. Oh, there's a victory parade. Yay, freedom fighters! You know, from a certain point of view, I'm not surprised that NATO can and others can take this view of citizens.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know when it happened, but it's as if at a certain point in time, people actually went extinct and some body snatchers took over, and these are the consumers.
And exactly, and that was when the citizens became consumers. And in terms of bodies, I mean, we're seeing how the NATO treats bodies. We're imposing our imperial we on people in Libya, on their bodies. We shoot their bodies, we bomb their bodies, we destroy their bodies with bombs. We have drones. There's been more than 100 drone attacks by NATO in Libya. There's been more than 1,000 air raids, and that's, they are the object of these attacks. There's an article by someone calling himself Nick Possum, and the title of that article is 100 Years of Bombing Arabs. And, you know, that's worth looking up, because that's part of what's going on here. And I know we've got to get going, but before we go, I know you had a lot of fun with the issue of some of these international bodies. You use the words our own people or their own people and consumers and pushing ideas on them. And certainly the pushing of intervention has been done by groups like Human Rights Watch. And, you know, people can read your article to get all the details. But isn't it interesting how groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, they only come in after the bombing has started for the most part? I mean, I've never heard cries and entreaties from Human Rights Watch to prevent a war. I've never heard them say, don't bomb Libya, don't attack Iraq, don't attack Afghanistan, or anything, or don't bomb Yemen. They never say that. They don't say don't escalate the war in Pakistan. But what happens is once the war starts, they come in and start publishing articles about human rights violations inside the country done by the other guys. So there was an article in The Independent. You mentioned The Independent. Well, they had an article called "These Indiscriminate Killers Leave Their Deadly Legacy from Libya to Lebanon." And what they were referring to was cluster bombs. Allegedly, Gaddafi was using them. So that's our prime concern. I guess NATO shot up Libya, destroyed the infrastructure. It's killed thousands of people now. It's demolished Tripoli. But we should be concerned that Gaddafi might be using cluster bombs, according to rebel reports, because Human Rights Watch said so.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. And of course, the fact that those cluster bombs, if they were used, they were provided by European suppliers. I believe the allegation is Spain, that the United States uses cluster bombs. The United States has not signed on to the treaty banning the use of cluster bombs. And when the United States uses these things, it does not score this kind of outrage that we see when Libya uses them. It's definitely a slanted and selective morality. Even our valuation of the individual that is at the center of our concept of human rights, we do everything possible to beat that individual down into a kind of passive consumer. This is an individual who, and you know, this is from a time when in Canada the meaning of democracy used to be seriously debated. This is an individual who experiences daily life as life in a dictatorship because they work from 9 to 5 in a corporation where they have no power and they have no say and they take orders. That's their daily experience. The real world of democracy is that for the individual. You know, people should look up the writings of Canadian political scientist C.B. McPherson. Again, dated. It's as if now people feel safe and taking freedom for granted as something that absolutely does exist in our society.
Well, that's right. It's something to export. We don't necessarily have it here, but we're gonna export it to other people.
Since we don't have it, it becomes something very cheap to export.
You got to ask yourself, as Maximilian Forte is pointing out, how much democracy do you have in your real life? When you get up in the morning to when you go to bed, how much of that is under your control, and how much of it is at work, at school, or somewhere else? That's a very interesting question. And on that note, we're going to have to leave you thinking there. Professor Forte, we're glad about this. People definitely need to go to Monthly Review Zine or your blog. That might be easier to find your particular article. That's Open Anthropology?
OpenAnthropology.org.
Okay, because you have been covering this for months now. There's multiple articles about Libya, media analysis, how we're being treated as consumers, passive consumers of information. And we appreciate your role in doing what you can to liberate us at a time when there's not much of a left, not much of a resistance, and a war on terror chorus that bisects the Republicans, the Democrats. We get it from Juan Cole, we get it from Robert Fisk, we get it from political parties on the left and the right, so we need to talk more about that. Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you so much, Brendan. It was a great pleasure.